We're extremely privileged tonight to have to be able to listen in on a conversation between these two gifted scholars and writers, both of whom held fellowships at the Cullman Center next door last year. Robin Cresswell, the poetry editor of the Paris Review and an assistant professor at Brown University, is a critic, translator, and scholar who specializes in Arabic literature and comparative modernisms. In 2010, he published his translation from the French of a novel by the Moroccan writer, I meant to ask you how to pronounce this, and I forgot, Abdel Fattah Kilito.
That's good.
Okay. Sorry. You can, okay. The Clash of Images. And as a fellow last year, he worked on his translation of, from the Arabic this time, of Sanaa Ibrahim's powerful first novel, That Smell, along with the author's Notes from Prison. And he writes about contemporary poetry and fiction for Harper's, N Plus One, and The Nation, among other publications. Among the terrific conversations that took place around the lunch table at the center last year were many between Robin and Adam Schatz, a contributing editor at the London Review of Books, who writes regularly about the Middle East for a number of publications, including the LRB, the New York Review of Books, The Nation, and Slate. He's also a consultant to the Open Society Institute's Arab Transitions Forum. Adam's latest piece for the LRB in the issue dated March 7th, 2013, which is this issue, is about Sanaa Ibrahim and Cresswell's new book. We definitely believe in a nepotism of excellence around here. So let's hear these two fine writers talk about the book.
Thank you, Jean, and thanks to everyone at the Cullman Center and the New York Public Library for making this event possible. Robin, it's a pleasure and an honor to be sitting with you here. I've long admired your essays on Arab literature in Harper's. They've been exemplary for their lucidity and elegance and attention to both the historical and formal dimensions of Arab fiction poetry. Apparently, Sanaa Ibrahim has not seen your translation. I think it will make him a very happy man, if it's possible for Sanaa Ibrahim to be happy. Not exactly the cheerful type. And Sanaa Ibrahim has finally found a translator worthy of his talents. He's also found a publisher, a publisher worthy of his talents, and that's New Directions. And I think that special mention should be made of Barbara Epler and New Directions, the people who introduced many of us to Roberto Bolaño. And in a sense, I think there's a relationship here. I think that, like Bolaño, Ibrahim is a left-wing modernist who's made, whose work is a response to, is haunted by the defeat of revolution. You could say that Ibrahim's experience of imprisonment under Nasser was the primal trauma of his work, as the fall of Allende was for Bolaño. We'll get to that and to various other questions raised by this astonishing novella. But first, because I suspect that a lot of people here have not read Ibrahim, I wanted to ask you if you could read the opening of this novel, That Smell.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. From the top. "What's your address?" the officer said. "I don't have an address," I said. He looked at me, surprised. "Then where are you going? Where you live?" "I don't know," I said. I don't have anyone." He said, "I can't let you go like that." "I used to live by myself," I said. "We have to know where you're living so we can come at night," he said. "One of the policemen will go with you." And so we went out into the street, the policeman and I, and I looked around curiously. It was the moment I'd been dreaming of for years, and I searched myself for some feeling that was out of the ordinary, some joy or delight or excitement, but found nothing. People walked and talked and acted as if I'd always been there with them and nothing had happened. The policeman said, "Let's take a taxi." And I saw that he wanted to have an easy time while I paid. We went to my brother's place, and he said to me on the stairs that he was traveling and had to lock up. So we went downstairs and then to my friend's house. My friend said, "My sister's here. I can't let you in." We went back down to the street. The policeman was getting annoyed. His eyes had a mean look, and I figured that he wanted a few piastres. "We can't go on like this," he said. "Let's go to the station." The station, there was another policeman. "You're a problem," he said. "We can't let you go." I sat across from him and set my bag on the floor and lit a cigarette, and when it was night, he said there was nothing he could do. He called in a third policeman and said, "Put him in the holding pen." So they led me to a cell with a fourth policeman standing by the door. He patted me down and took my money and put it in his pocket and pushed me into a big room with a wooden bench all around the walls, and I sat down on the bench. There were a lot of men there, and the door kept opening to let more in. I felt something in my knee. I put my hand down and sensed something wet. I looked at my hand and found a big patch of blood on my fingers, and in the next moment saw swarms of bugs on my clothing, and I stood up and noticed for the first time big patches of blood smeared on the walls of the cell, and one of the men laughed and said to me, "Come here."
Please.
Tell me when to stop. Some of the men were sitting on the ground, and one of them had to spread a ratty blanket on the ground, and I found a little space on the edge and sat there with my chin on my knees. The man with the blanket said to me, "Why don't you sleep?" But there was no room for me, so I said, "I'd rather just sit like this." Another one asked me, "Drugs?" "No," I said. "Robbery?" "No," I said. "Murder?" "No." "Bribery?" "No." "Counterfeiting?" "No." So the man got quiet and confused and began looking at me with a strange look.
And we never do find out in that smell what he's been in prison for, but the implication is that he's been in jail for his political activities, as Ibrahim was. Ibrahim spent, 5 years in prison?
1959 to 1964, yeah.
And he was in jail for his political activities.
Yeah, he was a communist. He joined the party in 1954 when he was about 17 years old. He was born in 1937. He joined the party in 54, and there was a general roundup of Egyptian communists by the Nasserist regime, which had come to power in 1952 for complicated reasons, which I could explain. In 59, basically all members of the Communist Party in Egypt were rounded up, which was a relatively easy thing to do for Nasser because there weren't that many of them, in fact. And they were given, I think, 8-year sentences, and most of them got out in 1964.
The irony, of course, is that they were among his most fervent supporters when he came to power in 1952.
Yeah, this was the this was something that actually split the Communist Party in Egypt, which, as I say, was quite a small party, and really a party of intellectuals with some allies in the labor movement. Whether or not to support Nasser, actually, it wasn't Nasser at the time, it was the Free Officers' Revolution. It was a military coup that came to power in 1952, and it wasn't clear what their policies were, in fact, except that they were nationalists of some sort. And there were many ideological strands within this coup, among them Muslim Brotherhood, among them communists, a smaller percentage. So there was a split among the communist parties whether or not to support this revolution or not. Sanallah was among the factions that did support Nasser, but the friendly feelings were never returned, and very soon after the coup, the officers acted very violently towards a textile strike. They imprisoned and then executed some of the labor leaders, and so relations got bad. They got better after Suez. There are many ups and downs to this relationship, but once Nasser became, as he did in 1956, really the leader of pan-Arab nationalism, became really the most popular politician in the entire Middle East, it would have been, in a sense, futile to go against him. And in any case, he was really advocating for some of the policies, whether it's domestic or foreign, which they were in support of, an anti-imperialist stance and nationalization on the domestic front. So they did support him. In 1958, there was a coup in Iraq. Lots of coups. There was a coup in Iraq which was friendly towards the communists. Nasser became worried about this because he thought the previous regime in Iraq was more friendly to him. Anyway, he became nervous about his own domestic fellow travelers, and he rounded them all up and put them in jail. Mm.
And so this obviously inspired very schizophrenic feelings on the part of people like Ibrahim, since Nasser was carrying out some of the policies that they espouse. I think you write in your wonderful introduction to the novel that he was in the peculiar position of having his best line stolen by the regime that had imprisoned him. It was in prison that Ibrahim really became a writer.
Yeah.
And found his subject, and also found his style. And you've translated the notes that he wrote in prison. I think he compiled them in the last 2 years of his time in jail, and somehow smuggled them out on Turkish cigar paper.
Yeah, it's a great story about that. He did keep these. He was in prison from 59 to 64. He started keeping notebooks, which are basically reading notes about what he was. What they were able to smuggle into the prison at the time. In the last 2 years of that, and he kept them first on notebooks, but then when it became clear, or he suspected that he might be able to smuggle them out, he transferred these notebooks to cigarette papers. Everybody was smoking cigarettes, so that was the kind of paper they had a lot of, and he figured they could stick it in their socks or something on the way out, which is more or less what happened. So the notes are actually not these notes, what we're calling notes from prison, which were published in a much fuller form in an Egyptian edition. They're not about daily life in prison so much as what he was reading. And he said, Sonella has said, that prison was indeed his university, and that this was where he really became an intellectual, became a writer. And so the notes, it became clear to me in reading the notes, and this is a novel that I've always kind of loved and felt strongly about, when reading these notebooks, it became clear to me that they were in fact a kind of laboratory of ideas for what went on in the novel, which he wrote right after he got out of prison. So it's a fascinating way of seeing what his models and influences, if we can use that word, were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Prison certainly was his university, I mean, as it was for so many writers, Malcolm X, Jean Genet. It's remarkable how much literature he was actually able to get hold of in jail, and what he was reading. How did he get hold of Hemingway and these Camus and other writers that he was reading?
The conditions in prison were indeed brutal, and he was tortured, and most of the prisoners were tortured, and so one would assume, given those kinds of conditions, that it would be hard to get reading material in. But that seems not to have been the case, and especially as time wore on, it wasn't the case. Because in between bouts of brutality, there were long stretches of boredom when the prison guards would want somebody to talk to, apparently. And there was lots of informal socializing between the prisoners' guards. So what happened was, when a guard would go to Alexandria or Cairo or some major city, he would be asked to bring back books or cultural supplements from newspapers. And this was a lot of what Ibrahim was reading. So it was kind of catch as catch can. And it's a somewhat random assortment of books that he was reading. But prison, like university, is all about reading things that, you don't necessarily have a choice about what you're going to read. And that was certainly true of him. So, he says that at one point, particularly difficult time, all he had was the Quran and the Bible to read. That was really tough. But for the most part, he had other things. The other place that they were able to get books was from a benefactor in Paris, a fascinating guy whom I know that you know something about, named Henri Curiel, who was came from a very wealthy Italian banking family, but grew up in Egypt and was Jew, and was active in anti-fascist politics in the 1930s, and then founded one branch of the Communist Party, the branch, in fact, that Sonola belonged to in the 1940s. And he was eventually expelled from Egypt, Curiel was. But he paid for the legal defense for all of the communists in 1959, and once he ended up in Paris after a stint in Rome where he formed something called the Rome Group, which was kind of the Egyptian Communist Party in exile, he sent them books and magazines, among them the Nouvelle Critique, which was really the organ, the house organ for the French Communist Party. So they also had this really kind of fascinating connection to Marxist life in France. And so some of the things that he was reading are very reminiscent of great literary political debates of the 30s and 40s between Marxist intellectuals like Lukács and Walter Benjamin and Brecht, debates which were still alive in the Nouvelle Critique.
And this was also just a few years after the 20th Party Congress and the Khrushchev revelations. So he's reading the Yevtushenko memoirs, and he's connecting that to the experience of Egyptian communists who had idolized Nasser and who continued to believe in him even after he threw them in prison. And he's seeing the links, right?
Yeah, there's a kind of haunting note that he has. He was, as you say, reading Yevtushenko, who was really the great Soviet poet of his day and gave readings to packed stadiums all across, who was allowed out all across Europe and even in, I think, college campuses in the States. A poet that we don't read anymore, actually, but at the time, one of the most famous poets in the world. And Yevtushenko's memoir was being published in L'Express, which is another French magazine. And in that memoir, he talks about Soviet prisoners who would scrawl on the walls of their prisons, "Long live Stalin," not at all ironically, meaning that with the notion that Stalin somehow wasn't responsible for the fact that they were in prison and all these other kinds of crimes. And indeed, Sanalla seems to have connected this with the very deep ambivalence that Egyptian communists had towards Nasser. Mm-hmm. So it was somewhat the same syndrome.
One of the very startling things about this novel, and that I think came through in your reading, is the style. It's stripped down. It's almost zombified at times. And Ibrahim was looking for a distinctive style in prison, right? I mean, he was looking to somehow capture the experience that he'd undergone and also to set himself apart from his peers in Egyptian literature, particularly, I would think, Naguib Mahfouz. Can you tell us a little bit about that style, which you call an anti-style, and about Ibrahim's place in Egyptian and Arabic letters?
So Naguib Mahfouz was indeed, I think, a kind of inescapable influence, presence in Egyptian letters, in part because he was, as a person, I think, so welcoming. He blurbed young writers and wrote enthusiastic reviews and was himself quite open to learning things from new writers, all of which made him actually kind of more inescapable, I think, and incredibly kind of decorous and genteel. What the rivalry, I think, was between these two writers, and there was one, really has to do with Cairo. Because Cairo was really Mahfouz's terrain as a writer. And he had mapped the place kind of from top to bottom. He had written about the prostitutes and the beggars and the thieves and the politicians, sometimes the same person. And he had written about, you know, the old neighborhoods, and he had written about the new houseboats, and you know, he had covered the whole landscape. And so if like Ibrahim, you're a young writer and Cairo is in some sense your material, which it was for him, then how do you find a place to write? What's your material? And I think in brief, the answer to that is that he discovered this kind of terrain of the everyday, which is the morning commute, your time in the bathroom, your time watching television at night, routine, in fact.
I mean, this book almost reads like a slacker novel at times.
Yeah, indeed. It's very much like that. Nothing happens. Not to give anything away.
He smokes.
But nothing happens.
He smokes, masturbates, tries to write.
Yeah, exactly. And that was not the kind of novel that Mahfouz was writing. I mean, you know, when you say that he was writing about the morning commute and watching television at night, you say, that seems a very obvious thing to write about. How is that innovative? But I think precisely because it is obvious, that's what we overlook. And that is something that he really, I mean, that's kind of his definition of what realism does, is look harder. That's one of his kind of mantras in a later book. Look at the things that you otherwise, that normally you overlook. Mm. So that was, I think, as far as kind of the content, so to speak, in the Marxist vein of things, that was the content. As far as the style, I think it is a version of modernism. I mean, any number of modernist styles have to do with paring away the rhetoric. What is it? Use absolutely no word that does not contribute to the presentation. That's Pound to the Imagists. There's always this minimalist impulse in any number of modernisms. I think there is actually a kind of parallel between the situation of Egyptian writers in the 1960s and, let's just say, Anglophone modernists in the teens and 20s, insofar as they felt that the previous generation, call it Victorianism, wrote with too much rhetoric, and they wanted a poetry, or they wanted a prose that was truth, was sincere, and spoke the truth about their contemporary life. They also thought that, and that it couldn't be done with.
Isn't that why he found Hemingway so refreshing? He contrasts Hemingway with his cool style with the flabby eloquence of post-Arab literature.
Yeah. Indeed, it wasn't Pound or Eliot. Although there's a moment in the notebooks where he does read Eliot, and he very dutifully notes what the definition of the objective correlative. You know, imagine in the southern deserts of Egypt in a kind of prison camp, you know, taking notes on the objective correlative. Al mu'adil al mawdu'i. It was a phrase that was new to me in Arabic. But really, it wasn't Eliot, and it wasn't Pound. It was Hemingway, who had been recently translated by kind of the great literary critic of the last century in Arabic, a guy named Ihsan Abbas, who happened to have translated Carlos Baker's interpretation of Hemingway. And in fact, lots of the things that Ibrahim was reading in prison, he was not reading firsthand. He was reading in translation, or he was reading in, you know, summary form, or he was reading through reviews. So it was very much this kind of bricolage effort, which is why I think it's not really a matter of influence. He was taking bits from here and bits from there and putting them together in a way that was useful to him.
And Brecht seems to have been a very pivotal figure for him because of his expansive and experimental idea about realism, right? It seems as though Brecht helped him to get away from the realism of Mahfouz.
Yeah, I mean, certainly of all the kind of modernist models for Ibrahim, Brecht, the notion of defamiliarization is very much what he's doing with the everyday, actually. Is he's saying, if you describe what you do every day in a really in an intense fashion, you will estrange yourself from the life you live. And that's really what's going on in this novel and in other novels of his as well. So there is that kind of defamiliarizing motive. There's also the sense that Brecht, who was also thought of himself as a modernist, was also an experimentalist. So that he almost uniquely among that group of Marxist intellectuals who debated this subject, thought that modernism and realism were in fact quite compatible, and that to do realist fiction, to be accurate and about your contemporary life, you had to be experimental, in fact, because the materials that you're using are so fleeting that in order to kind of be up to date and be contemporary, you also had to be experimental, meaning that your technique has to keep changing. And this is something that's been true about Ibrahim as a writer throughout his career, and is one of the reasons why he has been such an enormous source of, I think, such an enormous resource for young writers, is that his style has not remained the same.
And just as he moved away from the Mahfouz model, so he also resisted the temptations of socialist realism. There's no narrative of proletarian revolution in his work. In fact, there are very few consolations, period. I mean, this is an incredibly bleak book.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Which I imagine was quite controversial. I mean, this book was published in 1966, a year before the 1967 war, at a time of heightened tensions between Egypt and Israel, when Nasser was promoting the new Egyptian man and so forth. And the hero of this novel is not exactly
a
strapping example of virility.
No, he's a total loser. I mean, in the period, you know, you have to remember that I think the literary norm for the period was a local version of socialist realism, meaning heroic peasants rising up against their colonial or neo-colonial masters. That's not at all what's going on in this book, which is a book about, you know, this totally feckless dude in Cairo. You know, he goes around, basically the novel really is about him going around staring at women, fantasizing about them, not having any conversations with them, masturbating, looking for a job, not finding a job, going to the movie theaters, not having enough money to get into the movie theaters, and going to prostitutes and not being able to seal the deal,
so to speak.
I thought perhaps
you might want to read that passage.
Oh, yeah. Well, so one of the book is also about having writer's block. And it seemed, it's a book about the anxiety of coming up with a subject, what it is that you have to write about. And the problem here is that what he really has to write about, obviously, which is his experience in prison, is too traumatic, I think, for him to talk about in the same way that, you know, for Jake Barnes in Hemingway's
Sun
Also Rises.
That appears fleetingly, right? It appears fleetingly in these italicized flashbacks.
There's some reference to the fact that he was in prison. In flashbacks, another Hemingway-esque technique. Technique he really takes from Hemingway very directly, actually.
And there's that moment when he meets an old comrade of his who says that if you're with the people, you're not alone. But then the comrade sort of crumples and doesn't really seem to believe what he's saying.
Yeah, it's in many ways a novel about being kind of coming after politics when the revolution has failed, the Nasserist revolution and the communist one, too.
You have a very nice description when you say that the narrator's stupor is the days of depoliticization. It's what happens after politics, and that's what gives I think a very unusual texture to this novel of a flaneur, or a slacker for that matter, a walker in the city who really has nowhere in particular to go.
Yeah, and there is good historical reason for that kind of feeling, I think, which is that what happened to get, it's ironic that what happened to get Ibrahim out of prison is that Khrushchev visited Egypt in 1964 to celebrate the opening of the Aswan Dam. Egypt had asked for the United States to help build it. They had refused. They went to the Soviet Union. They did do it. 1964, it was completed. Khrushchev comes to Egypt to celebrate it and notes that all of the communists in Egypt are in jail, which is somewhat embarrassing. And they were going to give Nasser, you know, the Hero of the Soviet Union medal, but how do you do that when all of your domestic reds are being tortured? So that's why they let him out, in fact. That is the reason why they let them out. A year after that, The party voted to disband itself, which is one of the few cases in history where a communist party voted to disband itself, and they did. Because, in part, they thought that by joining the now single-party regime of Nasser from the inside, they would have more effective, they could be more effective. That turned out to be absolutely untrue. They were just neutralized. So the feeling in the novel is, you know, of a guy who comes back into Cairo with his party gone. It's been taken out from under him. And so the revolution, the Nasserist revolution and the communist revolution, as far as he's concerned, I think are both over.
Before you read that, you know, it's your point about the Aswan Dam actually reminds me that when Ibrahim first got out of prison, he had thoughts of writing a novel about the construction of the Aswan Dam, and he appears to have felt a kind of obligation to tell, you know, the national allegory, right?
Yeah.
To talk about the Egyptian struggle to, you know, to nationalize and so forth. And yet that's not what he did. I mean,
right.
Later he wrote that book. And in fact, in the there's a moment in these prison notes where he describes the Egyptian novelist as a kind of prophet whose role it is to guide the Egyptian people. I mean, he must lead and play a role in everyday life, armed with his technique, personal experience, self-awareness, persistence, and the readiness to sacrifice. It's an odd moment in the journals, because for the most part he's arguing for a very different kind of writing.
And I think that's something he learned. I mean, the first entries, and that's one of the first entries, are full of this kind of revolutionary romanticism with an exalted idea of what the writer's role in the revolution will be. And later on, he becomes a bit more he sees that the novelist will, especially in Egypt, where people don't really read novels. Well, they don't. I mean, it's just not the same. A poet, maybe you could have that kind of aspiration. A novelist, that would be really wild. But in any case, he was, I think, kind of chastised, not by experience, but by his reading, and came to have a very different idea of what the novelist's role would be, something more in line with a modernist revolution rather than a romantic revolution.
And it seems as though the epiphany came to him when he was reading his diaries.
As far as the style goes.
Yeah, the style.
Yeah. Yeah, he was, well, after prison, he was searching for a style and couldn't, you know, had maybe too many influences, in fact, too many things in his head, too many readings. And then noted that in the diaries that he was keeping in his home under house arrest, that he had actually a style of truth-telling, that it was really a style of witnessing. It was a style of very bare bones, in which he, I think, just ratchets up in the actual novel, so that it's a stylized kind of minimalism, a stylized anti-style.
Do you want to read that passage about his encounter with a failed encounter with a prostitute?
Yeah. So this is one of the more it's not grim. It's just kind of sad. But as I said, the novel is about writer's block, and one of the analogies for writer's block, obviously, is a kind of impotence that the narrator seems to have. And indeed, when the book was censored, because it was censored, it was banned upon first printing. It was never released in Egypt in 1966. Sanalla was taken into the Ministry of Information, and the guy kind of sat him down across from it, and the whole manuscript was marked up in red. And his first question was, why can't he sleep with the prostitute? Is he impotent? Which was very worrisome if you're used to socialist realism and these full-blooded, virile characters kind of machine-gunning the Zionist, which this is not. So this is, yeah, let me see here. So this is the scene. Hassan came in, and I told him we needed to get a woman right away. He said he would do his best and left. He came back in half an hour and said, my brother's on the stairs with a girl. Make yourself scarce for a while. We told her there were only two of us. I went to the kitchen and made some tea. Hassan came in and said his brother and the girl were in my room now. I carried the tea into the living room and put it on the table, then sat at the table. Hassan lit a cigarette and drummed his fingers on the table. Soon the door to the room opened and Hassan's brother came in and I shook his hand. I had never met him before. He was a big man in his 40s. Hassan went into the room and I offered his brother some tea. He said, "How are things?" "Very good," I said. I pointed to the room and said, "How is she?" He shrugged. "Not bad," he said. "We drove all over, but it was so late she was the only one we found." Hassan came out and said to me, "Your turn." I took him aside and I said, "I can't." He looked at me, surprised. "What do you mean?" "I don't know," I said. "I don't feel like it." He shook me. "You've got to go in there," he said. "This is a big deal." I said I knew that it was, but that I couldn't. "Come on," he said, and shoved me toward the door. I went in and locked the door behind me. Hassan's brother said from behind the door that the rubber was on the desk. I lit a cigarette and offered her one. She was sitting on the bed in her underclothes, wearing a cheap pink shirt with holes in it, like a white rag that had been dipped in blood and washed over and over again, but still kept the faded color of the blood. Her legs were bare. Her skirt was carefully folded on the desk. She said, "I don't want to smoke. Let's get on with it." "Let's have a cigarette first," I said. "What's your name?" "I want to get this over with," she said, and put her hand out to unbutton my pants. I turned her hand away gently and said, "Just sleep with me tonight, then leave in the morning." "Yeah, right," she laughed, and then pulled me toward her, trying to kiss me. I turned my mouth away from her face and stood up and took off my pants and underwear and picked up the rubber and began putting it on, but it ripped. I looked for another one on the desk. There wasn't one. The girl said, "I'm clean." I opened the door and called to Hassan, "I need one." And he gave me one from his pocket, and I put it on and threw myself on top of her. She tried to kiss me, so I moved my face away and finally got up and put my clothes on. The other two took her out, and I sat down and lit a cigarette. Ramsey came, and I told him I hadn't been able to sleep with the girl, and he made fun of me. He had managed it.
How shocking was this at the time, 1966? How was this very uncommon kind of writing in Egypt then?
Yeah. I mean, at the time it was. I mean, in the long view of Arabic literature, nothing is really shocking. I mean, some of the most wonderful and obscene poetry, I think, in world literature is classical Arabic literature. Some absolutely filthy kind of stuff. And absolutely heretical. Penises as minarets and domes as other things. In that sense, in the long sense, there are no taboos to be broken, I don't think. But in the short view, this was quite different. Because as I say, writers like Mahfouz and his generation, let's say, there was a certain kind of decorousness to what they were willing to say. And one of the great critics of the day who actually did review this book kind of before it was censored, he was reviewing a book that never actually came out, a guy named Yahya Haqqi, wrote this review saying that he was disgusted by it and criticized it for its, he called it physiological realism. And Sanallah's response in a piece he wrote later on was to say something like, well, you know, when you have people with, you know, electrodes attached to their penises in jail and having things shoved up their rectums, don't we deserve some sort of equivalent ugliness, that's his phrase, some equivalent ugliness in literature? And that's indeed what he's attempting to do, I think, to seek some sort of equivalent ugliness, which is also innovative. I think that's
even beautiful.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that comes through. Because I think it is.
The critics initially, the book was initially praised by critics in Egypt, those who managed to get a copy of the book. But then it quickly went out of circulation in Egypt, right? It was banned and didn't appear in an uncensored version until, what, mid-1980s?
It has a very complicated history. Yeah, but what happened was he managed to get it printed. So he had copies, which he sent to some friends, which is how it's done in Cairo for the most part. It's done sort of informally. And they wrote reviews. But then once it became clear that the Ministry of the Interior was going to ban it, they withdrew their reviews. This one by Yahya Haqqi came out so early that they didn't have time to take it back. Then the censor seized all the copies, and it was never released in 66. Later on, he published it in, he published excerpts from it in the in a Beiruti magazine, Sha'ar, which he later sort of regretted. And then he published it again, I think, in its full form in Morocco. But in Egypt, it wasn't published integrally until 1986.
And Ibrahim's view was that the censors had seized upon those sexually explicit passages because what really disturbed them was the account of torture or the implication that the trauma suffered by the hero had to do with political persecution. Is that right?
Yeah, well, actually, I don't know. I think we don't know because the archives aren't open, so we don't know what really disturbed the censors. In Ibrahim's telling of this anecdote where he comes to the censor and the guy says, why doesn't your hero sleep with the prostitute? Can't he get it up? His sense was that it wasn't so much the masturbatory scenes, but it was this hero who is impotent that really disturbed them. And probably, too, the style itself, which just doesn't prettify anything, refuses to prettify anything. That also, I think, as far as he is concerned, that was probably the most important thing. Because there aren't the implication of torture, yes, that's true. It is there. And who knows what really disturbed them. I don't know.
How influential was this? I mean, the novel came out in 66. He's gone on to have a very illustrious career as a novelist. He left Egypt for several years, but then returned in the mid-70s. The novel did make it into certain hands, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because he'd managed to grab several hundred copies. What kind of an influence did it have among young Egyptian writers?
An enormous influence. I think it's probably one of the most significant fictions written in Egypt since World War II, certainly for young writers. And I think Ibrahim's reputation among young writers really rests on two things. One is that kind of experimentalism that I was discussing, the fact that he has this kind of relentless drive to innovate, to come up with new techniques that are adequate to the subject matter. The other thing is that he is an independent. In a country where the state cultural apparatus is incredibly powerful and dominant, where it's basically impossible for a fiction writer or poet to make a living off of their fiction. And you say, well, it's pretty hard in this country too, but there are no MFA programs in Egypt. And Naguib Mahfouz was, held a government position for his whole life, basically. So it's basically impossible to get out of this, but Ibrahim has. He is, with one very brief exception at the beginning of his life, he's never held a government position. And so this kind of refusal to be dependent upon the state for its largesse makes him kind of a literary saint as far as the young generation is concerned. I mean, I think that really can't be underestimated. He's lived very modestly in a flat in Heliopolis his entire life. And kind of his most famous act, political act in Egypt at least, was in 2003 he was awarded a very prestigious prize by the Ministry of Culture with a large cash component. And he went to the opera house where they were having the ceremony and got up and basically just eviscerated Mubarak's foreign policy, his domestic cultural policy, torture and corruption, and then said, and this is with the Minister of Culture sitting on the stage with him, I refuse this prize because this government doesn't have the legitimacy to give it. And people just couldn't believe their ears, I think. But in fact, that's something that independence has been a principled stance his entire career. And is one of the reasons I'm so happy that New Directions has done this, because I think it was a great independent publisher, and he's really, that's kind of his...
Sort of a model of candor, really, about what Egypt had become over those years.
Yeah, yeah, indeed, indeed. I mean, that, and that was one of the things that attracted him to Hemingway's style, was that he interpreted it as, this minimalism, he interpreted it as a mode of truth-telling. You know, he takes a lot of notes from Hemingway. Basically, the note is, write what you see and hear. That's not what we necessarily take from Hemingway, but that certainly was what he did. This style of a historical witness.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take some questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I hope there are some. I should say that there is, in fact, there was a previous translation of this novella, which was done in the very early 70s by a guy named Dennis Johnson Davies, who is a Canadian translator, who's translated many things from the Arabic, and is quite a very competent translator. That was, you know, 40 years ago now, and translations age faster than lots of other kinds of writing. And that book has been out of print for a very long time. And the strategy of that translation, which I think is very much a product of its time, was indeed a domesticating translation. It wanted to make this, what I think of being a radical work of fiction, readable. So he did things like break up what is, in fact, in the Arabic, an unbroken paragraph for the entire book, with the exception of these flashbacks, which are also just unbroken chunks of text. He broke it up into paragraphs. The dialogue is indented. And he also made these lower-class Egyptian characters sound like, you know, kind of plummy British middle-class characters. So I did have a kind of agenda insofar as I wanted to make... What I really wanted to find was some sort of equivalent strangeness in the English for what I felt was there in the Arabic. I mean, and that's something I think translators are always trying to do. Just for instance, and I tried to take some notes. I mean, I had kind of Hemingway's voice in my head as I was translating. And so one of the ticks of the translation, for instance, is this use of repetition, which you might have even noticed from the passages I've read, which I haven't made up, but which in the Arabic actually isn't entirely a radical. It's sort of expected, but which in the English, I think, still sounds to us, even though we've kind of ingested Hemingway, still does sound to us a little bit strange. So I wanted to make it, I did want to try to make it as disturbing as I could to jaded American
you
readers.
Also gave it a, the title's also slightly different. The title of Dennis Davies Johnson's
yeah, we had to come up with a different
Was the smell of it.
Yeah,
and this is that smell, which I think is a fantastic title.
Yeah, and the smell of it sounds to me literary, in a way that smell doesn't. And that was, you know, that was the challenge, I suppose, was to find a style that doesn't strike you as literary, even though we all know all styles are literary. No, the editing refers to what I did with the notes from prison. So the notebooks that he kept, the notebooks are about 200 pages. They were published in 2003, 2004, I think, in Cairo, integrally, all 200 pages or so, with Sonullah's kind of copious notes. And a lot of those notes are just would need too much contextualization for an American reader, and they just have to do with projects that never came to fruition. A lot of them, writing projects that never came to fruition. So I've reduced the prison notebooks from about 200 pages down to about 25 pages or something like that. So in that sense, I was selecting, and my thought in doing that was really to point out what seemed to me the most significant and interesting for an American readership models that Sonella was using here. So not only Hemingway, but there are a lot of things in the notes about Virginia Woolf, about John Dos Passos, about writers that we don't necessarily think of as a political prisoner in Egypt in the 1950s and 60s reading, but he was quite interested in them, and also notes about Italian neorealism and films that he had never seen, and books that he had never read, really, too.
I mean, they also satisfy a real hunger after you've read a novel. I mean, they make the experience of the novella so much richer. I mean, this is a book after you read this book, you can't go back to what you were doing before, and you have a lot of questions. And so, I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about this, about the prison notes.
Yeah, I think it's just a fascinating, it's really like the working notes for how he, not having to do with the plot, but really how he thought about literature, going into the process of writing a novel. So, but some notes were more significant, I thought, than others.
And some of them are quite poetic, actually. I like that remark about the mouth, like a prison, enclosed, has living things inside of it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
There are some very suggestive phrases.
Well, there are many, many suggestive phrases. That's the thing. I mean, they are notes, so they're fragments. Some of them are fragments. Some of them are quite long passages of cogitation. But some of them are just kind of what he calls, gleanings, where he has an idea and he writes it down, and there's no follow-through, but which seems to me suggestive. So there are those kinds of things, too.
And he's how old? He's 28, 29 when he's writing these? I mean, they have this real thrill of discovery about them.
No, he's 22, 23.
22, okay.
Yeah, he has notes like, must read Proust. And then, like, a couple of months later, it'll be like, must read Ulysses. And I felt like, well, that's what it's like to be 22.
And he's often writing.
And sometimes you get to it, and sometimes you don't.
He's often writing about things which he couldn't have seen. I mean, there are a couple of paragraphs about Jean Rouch's Cinema Verite, and right. I doubt he had the chance to see any of Jean Rouch's work in prison, unless they were screenings of Jean Rouch films in the Al Wasat Desert Prison, which I highly doubt.
They were a very enterprising bunch. I wouldn't put it past them. They put on plays. They were quite. It really was a university, but no, I don't think they got Jean Rouch in. And that's what I think is quite interesting about the whole process, is that I think he really approached these texts with no sense of awe. I mean, he wanted to find things that were useful to him in his particular situation. And because I think he was encountering them in excerpted form or in translation, that helped him have this, what I think is a very healthy sense, lack of awe, so that he could, take Yevtuchenko and take some Hemingway and add in some Virginia Woolf and make something entirely new in Arabic literature. What is his attitude, or what is... Oh, you mean the revolters? I think that he said actually relatively little at the beginning of the in the spring after the Arab Spring began. He said something like he acknowledged that he was very surprised, as most people were, that he didn't think Egyptian youth had it in them, and so he's very pleasantly surprised. that they did, but was worried and wouldn't give it the name of a revolution precisely because he didn't think they had a program. And I think he's been somewhat prophetic in that way. Sanalla has for a long time been extremely critical of Islamist trends in Egyptian politics. I mean, any Islamist character that appears in one of his books is just a kind of capitalist with rosary beads and a beard. I mean, that's his kind of demythologization of Islamists. So he's very disappointed, obviously, with what's happening now, insofar as I can tell. But a lot of young writers have gone to him over the last 2 years or so asking what his opinion is, and I don't think he has any cheery news to give them. That's my sense of it. Yeah, those are great questions. As to why he wasn't arrested, there was no Communist Party. And he was somewhat saved, I think, by the fact that he was a communist, who weren't seen as nearly the kind of threat that that Islamists were. The Communist Party has never, since Nasser, since this period in the early 60s, has never suffered the kind of oppression that... that Islamists did. The Sadat period was somewhat different. He actually encouraged the Islamists to kind of take over the campuses from the leftists. But in any case, the fact that he belonged to this relatively small party of intellectuals and was writing novels that most people didn't read, I think that certainly protected him. And he wasn't, in a sense, the fact that he wasn't involved with state cultural apparatuses meant that he was actually seen as very marginal, which is exactly where he wanted to be. So perhaps he was thought to be unthreatening in that sense as well.
The Mubarak regime wasn't really in the business of imprisoning writers by 2003.
Yeah, and
anyway.
The Mubarak regime is not Saddam Hussein. I mean, it's a very different kind of atmosphere. The other question about what was it? Remind me.
His ideals. What
oh,
what
well, I think
writing?
I think actually one of the ideals is really a kind of fidelity to this experience of communism. What it would mean to be a communist without a communist party anymore. I mean, I think that he really is a Marxist without a movement in some sense, and that gives his writings a real critical edge in Egypt. It's also true that as the years have gone by, he's become very nostalgic, oddly, about Nasserism, because indeed Nasserist politics, they did represent his anti-imperialism, these policies of nationalization, a kind of socialist drive, that was there. Whereas when Sadat came to power in the early 70s, he opened up the market. He turned away, in foreign policy terms, he turned away from the Soviet Union and towards the United States. He really, consumerist culture, which is one of Ibrahim's great themes, really begins, I mean, lifestyles, Egyptian lifestyles, that really begins in the 1970s. And so looking back, the period of Nasserism when Egyptians were making their own products, he has lots to say about the products that Egyptians made for themselves in the 1960s, it's almost this kind of East German situation where he's nostalgic about all those communist era, for East Germany, communist era commodities. All that takes on a kind of rosy-colored tinge when he looks back on it through the experiences of Mubarak and Sadat. I think there's a kind of fidelity to the experience of being a leftist in the 1960s. I think that really is what keeps him writing.
Is it in some ways a fidelity to the people he knew in prison, you know, his old comrades? Some of the tenderest moments in this novel involve these italicized passages about his experiences in prison and fallen comrades. And
yeah, I think that's part of it. He does, and there is a kind of tenderness there for those people, and that's part of the historical experience I'm trying to kind of evoke here, which is centered around these guys that he spent 5 years with in prison, and who, after they got out, were really disappointed by all the political possibilities that they saw around them. So how do you become an engagé novelist when there's no politics to engage with, as far as he's concerned? But actually, that he's turned that into a very productive predicament.
I mean, no one even asks him where he's been, what he's thinking in this novel. I mean, the novel is very much a roman à clef, isn't it?
Oh yeah, the novel is. It is based on his experiences right after prison, and there's a tremendous kind of alienation. But as you say, you know, the bleakness. You know, I think that there's some notes in here about reading Camus, about reading L'Étranger. It's way bleaker than that. I mean, by comparison, you know, Merceau just seems like a total ham. Really, when he's, you know, at the end of the novel, when he's like, oh, I hope they welcome me with cries of hate. I mean, that there's no way that he would go there. Well, Adam had a very nice line, actually, in his review, which is, it's black, not noir, you know. I can't say anything about his relationship to Naguib Sarour. As far as the style and how much it served as a model, I think that it has. I mean, I think the idea, the compulsion to keep stripping literature of its rhetorical excesses, which in the Egyptian context, I think, are very much aligned with a kind of refusal to tell the truth about what's happening. I think that drive is very much alive in lots of younger writers. Although, you know, things change, and younger writers now, I think, are writing. I don't think the bleakness has necessarily translated, certainly not these days. I don't think that has necessarily been the thing that gets translated from Sonella, but I do think that this agon, this struggle with the previous generations and their kind of Baroque rhetorical excesses and the link that he makes between that kind of writing and a certain kind of political life, which he wants to refuse. I think that certainly is alive and well among young writers.
Can you share the experience of the translator in the process before?
I'm not a veteran translator. This is only the second book that I've worked on. I think one of the things that I enjoyed most about it, actually, was, and that I'm
sort of proud of, I suppose. Translators always have, especially when you're translating from languages that are not well represented in the language that you're translating into, like Arabic, there's always this problem of how to provide context, which gets solved in different and inevitably insufficient ways, through footnotes, through glosses in the text that aren't actually signaled as glosses, because there's a whole political experience here that, unless you know something about Egypt in the 50s and 60s, which is hard to for an American reader to have kind of access to it. But I think that in doing these notebooks, I think in providing, in giving them as a kind of appendix and providing, using them, using his own words, not mine, to provide the context for the work, how it should be received, I think that's especially successful here, that that I didn't have to do any footnoting, and I didn't have to do any glosses, and I let him explain the work himself. And I think that was something I was proud of.
Robin, I want to thank you for producing a luminous translation of a very memorable, very powerful novel that I hope you'll all have a chance to read, and also for providing a context in which we can understand Sanaa Ibrahim's place in Egyptian letters and indeed in Egyptian political life. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.